MacCast, Sunday, February 4th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Another week, a little bit more Apple news to bring you. Not a ton of stuff going on this week, but we got a few things to talk about in this episode. We're going to get into more claims of disappointing iPhone sales. Is that really the case? Apple's first quarter 2018 results came through, and maybe not surprising, they were pretty darn good. Apple Custom Silicon is making its way potentially into future Macs. We can expect a little bit less from iOS 12, and we're going to talk about why that's a good thing. And also, we've got some happy Apple support stories, also more on HomePod stuff, some questions from you related to HomePod, also doing remote support on iOS. We're going to talk about one way you might be able to accomplish that, and a whole lot more on this episode. But I want to kick things off, starting off with a report that Nikkei ran last week, claiming that Apple had notified their suppliers that they needed to cut first quarter production targets on the iPhone X in half, down from 40 million units to just 20 million units. This kind of kicked off a little doomsday scenario in the Apple news. You know, your typical Apple is doomed, iPhone sales are plummeting, and Apple is not going to be able to recover. Now, there was a little bit of panic going on. I don't know if it was that extreme, but a lot of people were reporting that this was really, really bad for Apple. And the report also suggested that the cuts were specifically due to the fact that iPhone X sales were, quote-unquote, lower than expected for Apple. And in the same piece, they also noted that Apple was expected to maintain the total production targets of 30 million units for the lower-priced models such as the iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, and iPhone 7. We talked about this a little bit last week, that there's this general story going around that the iPhone 10 is doing very poorly and the iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and 7 are doing better. And while I don't dispute that Apple may have reduced their orders from some or many of their suppliers, cutting production a little bit, I really don't think that the reason for it is what we're hearing about. You know, Apple often does this after a major product launch, where they start ramping up production in advance of releasing new iPhone models. So that would be all of the models for last year in 2017, the iPhone 8, the iPhone 8 Plus, and the iPhone 10. So they ramp up all that production, they get all of this supply going into the supply chain, and then after that period, after that first quarter, that final quarter of the year, they start to wind things down a little bit, and they go back to suppliers and they say, okay, you need to start cutting back a little bit. And there's always a debate over what percentage that is. It usually varies between like 10%, I think we've seen in past years, up to like 30% on the higher end. So 50% would be a major cutback, but we really don't know. We don't have a lot of details about which supplier this was, where it was coming from, and all that stuff. It was just not a very good report. And again, I question the reason behind it, you know, making that conclusion that it's because of lower than expected iPhone X sales, mainly because there isn't any other evidence and we haven't heard any other reports to support that fact. As a matter of fact, we've heard mostly things to the contrary. A Kantar World Panel report found that for last month, for December, iPhone X sales, or iPhone X, was among the top three best-selling devices across Europe, urban China, Japan, Australia, and the U.S. So selling very well in all of the major markets where you would expect Apple to be selling iPhones. There was also data from Counterpoint for the fourth quarter of 2017 showing that all three of Apple's iPhones were top sellers. And they claimed that in the U.S., the iPhone X actually outsold the iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus by a 2-to-1 margin. So a lot of contradictory data. And then as far as how large the cutbacks were, we had an executive from a company called Murata in Japan, a company believed to be helping Apple with the liquid crystal polymer-based flexible circuit boards for iPhones. And he told Reuters that it was their understanding that the cut was not as large as the Nikkei reports were claiming. So definitely a lot of things in that report were in dispute, although you wouldn't have known that if you were just following a lot of the major Apple news blogs, because a lot of them were reporting that this cut was directly due to lower than expected iPhone X sales. So I don't think that's what's going on. I didn't think that was what was going on. And then, of course, we have Apple's first quarter of 2018 results. Now, it's important to remember, because I always get a little bit confused by this. Apple's first quarter of 2018 is what, for most of us, we would think is the last quarter of 2017. So it's the period covering October, November, and December of 2017. And so they had those results, and based on statements from Tim Cook and just the numbers in general, I think the iPhone X is doing just fine and probably just as well as Apple would have expected. And I think I mentioned that as my opinion on the previous episode of the MacCast as well. But as far as the numbers go for Q1 2018 for Apple, they had a record $88.3 billion in revenue for the quarter that beat their own guidance. And they generated about $20.1 billion in profit. As far as what they sold 77.3 million iPhones. Yeah, that's a lot of iPhones. 13.2 million iPads and 5.1 million Macs. Now, you compare that to the same period last year where they sold 78.3 million iPhones. And yeah, so they sold 1 million fewer iPhones, but that's not too bad. That's pretty close. Last year, they sold 13 million iPads, so iPad sales were up slightly year over year, and 5.3 million iMacs, so iMac sales just down 0.2 million. So again, overall, a very good quarter in terms of matching up the numbers from last year, and even better in terms of the revenues, because the revenues were actually record. So fewer iPhones by a hair, but iPhone revenue itself was actually up 11%. Year over year. So bumping that price point up on the iPhone X certainly helped the bottom line. And then Tim Cook said when he was asked about it that the iPhone X was actually Apple's top selling iPhone every week since it shipped in November. So that's in direct contradiction to all of these reports that iPhone X sales were not going so well. A few other notes of importance from the quarterly results. International sales accounted for about 65% of the quarter's revenues. Apple Watch doing very, very well, seeing 50% growth in unit sales and revenue for the fourth consecutive quarter. So Apple Watch continues to be a big seller for Apple. As a matter of fact, total revenue from all wearables, that would be Apple Watch, your Beats 1 headphones, AirPods, all of that revenue was up almost 70% year over year. So people are loving the AirPods. Tim Cook also pointed out his favorite statistic that customer satisfaction has been through the roof. So everybody's extremely happy with their Apple products. And just breaking down revenue by product segment, iPhone still accounts for about 70% of Apple's revenue. That's followed by services next, generating 10% of Apple's revenue, followed by the Mac at 8%, iPads at 7%, and all of that other stuff, the Beats headphones, AirPods, iTunes, all that stuff coming in at about 6% of total revenue for Apple. But all in all, again, a massively successful quarter by any stretch of the imagination. And overall, sales, unit sales, I think, are still doing very well. And the big number that matters, of course, is all that profit. And I don't think we have to worry about Apple being doomed anytime soon. One other thing on iPhones, we had been talking about all of the rumors of a possible iPhone SE 2 model coming out. Many of the rumors had been pointing to it having a glass back and support for wireless charging. Analyst Ming-Chi Kuo has some doubts about that. He thinks that if Apple does do an iPhone in the spring here that it's probably not going to be a majorly redesigned one. Actually, something that I also supported. I didn't think these rumors of Apple doing a massive redesign on the iPhone SE were really going to be the thing. He claims that with the rumored three new designs that he had already been talking about, the 6.1 LCD model and the two upper-end iPhone X updated models, so the 5.8-inch iPhone X for 2018, and also a supposedly new 6.5-inch large iPhone X. He says Apple's working on those for the fall, and they really just don't have the resources to do a major redesign of the iPhone SE. And I dispute that a little bit. I think if Apple really wanted to do a major redesign, they could make the resources available. They could spend some of those resources. But I really just don't think that the SE needs to have a major update. I think Apple will, just like Ming-Chi Kuo alludes to, if they do anything, they will update the SE with just some minor updates. So a new processor, a new CPU, possibly a lower price point. And that'll be about it. You know, it still is a very good seller for Apple. It is due for an update, so I think we will get a minor bump. But don't expect any major new features like an edge-to-edge display or the move to wireless charging or a glass back. It's kind of it's very likely going to have a design very similar to the current generation. A new report from Bloomberg claims that Apple is working on at least three updated Mac models with new custom coprocessors for release later this year. The piece also says that it's just a matter of time before Apple brings a Mac to market with its own custom designed chips. So what they're talking about here is the T-series processor, which we've seen so far, the T1 in the Touch Bar MacBook Pro, which handles all of the kind of Touch Bar features and features its own little operating system. And then now in the new iMac Pro, we have the T2 series chip, which is handling a lot of the security, the secure enclave, some of the initial firmware booting sort of functionality. And they're expecting that Apple is going to continue that trend in future models. We've been hearing about this idea of it kind of having a coprocessor, custom designed silicon from Apple that's going to handle a lot of the lower level functions and also can help maybe boost battery life, especially on models like, say, a new MacBook or a new MacBook Pro. So Apple expected to continue that trend. They didn't mention specifically which new Mac might feature that, but I have a pretty good guess that it could be maybe the new Mac Pro that we're waiting on and hoping Apple will tell us something about sometime here soon. Although we haven't heard too many rumors recently related to that. We know a new Mac Pro is coming. We just have really no idea when it might be coming out. If I were to venture to guess, I'm going to think maybe sometime in the second quarter, maybe right around a Worldwide Developer Conference. That seems like the right event and the right timing for Apple to maybe make a Mac Pro announcement. But that's just a total guess on my part. And there certainly is a lot of evidence recently that Apple does want to design and build what I'm going to say is the whole widget, something they've always wanted to do on all of their products. And so what I'm talking about here is the idea that Apple will eventually bring out a Mac with its own custom designed processor. They certainly have a history of it in their other products like the iPhone, and Apple's R&D spending actually just passed $3 billion for the first time. So they're spending a lot of money figuring out a lot of stuff, and chip designs and chip manufacturing is a big part of that. They have labs all over Cupertino. They have a bunch in Israel now, and they've been reportedly poaching a lot of chip engineers in the recent years. And as you know, if you've been listening to the MacCast, they've also been buying up various design companies over the past years, processor design companies. So I think it all just makes sense because ultimately, if they create their own processors, they're going to have much tighter control over the hardware and the software integration, and that can lead to major advancements in things like efficiency and power. Apple can really tune the specs of their products to the operating system, and you can take advantage and leverage that to do a lot more with seemingly less. And again, we've seen that exemplified over and over again with the iPhone. Competitive smartphones use a lot more memory, eat a lot more power than Apple's smartphones do, yet consistently Apple's phones outperform the competitive models. And I think we could see similar kinds of advantages if they can bring their own processors to the Mac. Now, when is that going to happen? I'm not expecting it to happen maybe even this year, but they're certainly working on it. And they also get the advantages of potentially lower cost components. They also keep a lot of their technology in-house, meaning that they can keep it secret from competitive partners like Samsung or Qualcomm or other people who are trying to figure out what Apple is doing. There's also even rumors at this point that Apple may even make their own cellular broadband chips at some point for the iPhone. Again, I think we're a ways off from that happening, but it could. More immediately, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that now Apple plans to use Intel as its exclusive supplier for baseband chips for their 2018 iPhone models. Originally, it was thought that Qualcomm would get about 30% of the orders, but Apple's ongoing legal battles with Qualcomm may have changed that. Still, Qualcomm might not be completely out of future broadband chips for the iPhone if they can settle their patent lawsuits with Apple. They've been working on that, although it's been on again, off again, if you've been following that fight. Or if Intel fails to get their chips ready for the new 5G networks that are coming in time, then at some point Qualcomm could be back in. But it's looking like maybe the 2018 iPhones are only going to feature Qualcomm chips. And then the Financial Times reported, and Apple has confirmed, that they are looking into a limited number of reports from users who are experiencing delays with incoming calls on their iPhone X. I haven't seen this personally. I think Mac Rumors was trying to confirm if they could get an iPhone to do this, but supposedly there are a number of support threads from iPhone 10 users who are saying basically what's happening is a phone call comes in, but the iPhone screen is not waking up. It's not giving you the option to pick up the call for up to like 10 seconds. And if it goes that long, it'll often just jump to voicemail and you won't be able to pick up the call. So I would imagine that would be extremely frustrating. Apple is apparently aware of the issue in some iPhone 10s and they are looking into the problem, but it doesn't appear to be something that was fixed with the latest iOS 11.2.5 update that came out, I think, last week. So I'd be curious, have you had this issue with your iPhone 10 and phone calls and not being able to pick up your phone calls? I personally haven't, knock on wood. Luckily, I haven't, but I'd be curious to know if anybody in our community is being impacted by that. I think I told you last week or the week before that there were some rumors that Apple was in a bidding war for a new TV series from J.J. Abrams. They were in a bidding war with HBO. It's a new sci-fi series. At the time, we didn't know what it was called, but now we're hearing it's called Demi-Monde. And according to The Hollywood Reporter, it looks like, unfortunately, HBO won out. They're saying mainly because Abrams was impressed with their handling of Westworld. He also has a working relationship with HBO on some other projects, and Apple's kind of an unknown entity at this point. Apple just getting into, with their worldwide video division, creating original content series. So he wanted to go with a little more known entity. Apple was certainly in there and willing to spend money, but ultimately it looks like they did lose out. I'm still very excited about the number of shows that they have and the number of the ones that we've talked about here on the MacCast, but I have to say it would have been really cool to have a J.J. Abrams sci-fi series being produced and distributed by Apple. But not going to happen at that point. In more positive news for Apple's worldwide video division, looks like they picked up another new member of their executive team. Dana Tuinier was supposedly hired away from the Paramount Network by Apple's worldwide video division to be their creative executive for comedy. She's going to be overseeing shows like the new Kristen Wiig series that we had heard about that's reportedly being produced by Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine Company. And then one little bit, other bit of entertainment news related to Apple and the iPhone this week. Director Steven Soderbergh says he shot his latest feature film, Unsane, entirely on the iPhone. They kind of did this in secret. It was reportedly shot over just about a week, so it was a pretty big or pretty quick production, but he called the experience, quote, one of the most liberating experiences I've ever had as a filmmaker. He was super excited about the iPhone X and this movie. He praised the 4K resolution on the iPhone and said that the footage, even on a 40-foot screen, looks, quote, like velvet, and said that shooting on the iPhone was a game changer. Supposedly, it was filmed last summer, so it was likely shot on like an iPhone 7 Plus, so not even an iPhone 10. And I actually assume it wasn't just one iPhone 7 Plus, but probably a whole army of them. And he said he even was able to begin editing the film right on set and kind of show the director, or show the actors he was working with, you know, his vision. So it really was a great way to work on the film. So beyond just shooting with the iPhone, it sounded like a lot of flexibility. And he was asked, how likely would it be for him to use iPhones on all of his movies going forward? And he said he would consider it, but kind of stopped short of saying he would use the iPhone exclusively. But he did say that it would have to be a pretty good reason for him not to use the iPhone for filming. And this is a guy that's shot on, you know, like red 4K camera stuff. And so I wouldn't dismiss this. You know, in the past, we've heard about other filmmakers using the iPhone for their films. I think the movie Tangerine, which was at Sundance and was critically acclaimed and did very well there, that was shot on an iPhone. And I think we're going to start seeing more and more of this. But here we have a major Hollywood director shooting an entire film on the iPhone. And, you know, that can't be understated how significant that is. I mean, that's just amazing. And again, it's older technology, the iPhone X, even better technology. So I think it really opens up filmmaking in a huge, huge way and just adds vindication for the iPhone. And probably even more importantly, for iOS as a content creation platform, something that a lot of people have always levied against iOS and the iPhone, is that it can't be used for content creation. It's mainly for content consumption. And this certainly goes against that statement. I love Apple Pay. I love using it. I love the technology. I think it is absolutely fabulous. As you know, in recent times, I've been a little bit critical, though, of Apple's rollout of Apple Pay to retailers. I think they've done a great job integrating with the banks and the credit card companies, but at least here in the U.S., it always feels like there's not enough places that accept Apple Pay. Well, this week, Jennifer Bailey, Apple's head of Apple Pay, was at the National Retail Federation Conference in New York City. I guess this was sometime this month. And she spoke to CNET of Japan about the success of Apple Pay. And interestingly, in the interview, she claimed that Apple Pay is now supported at 50%, so one out of every two retailers in the U.S. is supporting Apple Pay, at least according to her. And she is now calling it the, quote, world's most accepted contactless payment technology. And in the interview, she said that Apple is really focusing on creating a new shopping experience focused on application settlement, loyalty programs, and collaboration between stores and mobile. And what does she mean by that? She means that it's the overall experience that Apple is trying to build between the app, the technologies inside the phone and the device that you're making the purchase on, and also just the seamless experience of moving that into Apple Pay and to helping retailers kind of complete the transaction, right? So beginning to end, they're going to be able to provide technologies that help retailers make your shopping experience better and for the retailers help sell you stuff ultimately, right? And she gave examples like using ARKit and the TrueDepth camera system to help customers, say, better visualize products and how maybe they might fit in their home. So you think of something like the IKEA app, where you can pull up a piece of furniture, you can actually use ARKit to drop it into your environment, see how it's going to look in your house, and when you are happy with that, then you can simply complete the purchase and ordering of that with Apple Pay in one simple, easy transaction, and that's going to get your shipping address, your credit card information, all of that all at once, and it really helps reduce the steps to ultimately you making a purchase. And that's good for not only the consumer, but also good on the retailer side. And that's really what I love about Apple Pay, but I do have to question and ask if, wow, 50% of retailers, that doesn't seem to be my personal experience at retail. I have to say it's gotten a lot better in the last few months. There does seem to be a lot more places where I can use it, but there's also a lot more places where I've met with resistance. So I'm going to have to think about that. One out of two? Yeah, that could be. I guess that could be if I'm really thinking about it and I'm really trying to be honest about it. I wish it was more, though, because I love using Apple Pay, and I wish I could use it everywhere. But sounds like Apple Pay growth is pretty good. One other quick retail thing to note about, Apple is planning to open its first Austrian store in Vienna. That's going to happen on February 24th. And I have to say, some of the images of even the store under construction look amazing. Apple always does different sort of facades as they're working on it. This location, it looks like it's in a beautiful shopping plaza or center there in Vienna. And from the outside, they have this cool black and white patterned decorated facade sort of covering up the windows. You should, if you get a chance, just Google Austrian store, Apple store, and you'll be able to see these images. It's kind of really neat. And Apple is integrating that stuff, I think, into their launch campaign for the new Vienna store. So if you happen to be in the area on February 24th and you stop in, grab me some pictures. I love seeing pictures. Many of you at the different Apple store openings will send me pictures or images or videos. I love getting that stuff. So shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and maybe I'll even try to post some of them up on the website or at least share them with you on Twitter if I do get some. So new Vienna store, Apple's first Vienna store, opening up on February 24th. Be prepared to expect a lot less features from iOS 11. And I know we don't even know what features we might have gotten, but there's a report from Axios via Ina Fried, who says that Apple has decided, or at least they've heard that Apple has decided to delay some of the major new features they were planning for iOS 12 until 2019. Reportedly, Craig Federighi had a meeting and told his staff about the change in direction earlier this month. And some of the features that are being pushed are things like a total refresh of the home screen and sort of how you interact with icons there. Also, they're supposedly delaying a revamp of the CarPlay user interface. They're also pushing back improvements to core applications like Mail, and supposedly they were looking at a revamped Photos application that would include new algorithms that would better automatically sort your pictures. So they were going to help you with your Photos organization, and that is being pushed off. So a bunch of major new features. Why would they be doing that? Well, supposedly Apple is going to instead focus on security, reliability, and performance improvements of the existing OS and apps. And I have to say, I'm totally fine with that. I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't think there are any major new features that I'm really looking for in iOS 12. I would love it if everything just worked faster, was more reliable, if I got better battery life, better security. You know, Apple had some missteps this year. I think we can be honest about that, especially toward the end of the year. And I think it was because they're really trying to do almost too much at this point. And we can just dial it back. They can slow things down a little bit and really give us a good, robust operating system, especially on the iPhone and iPad. I think that's ultimately a good thing. But just so you don't panic, it doesn't mean there's not going to be any new stuff in iOS 12. They're just dialing it back a little bit. So they're reportedly still planning a lot of improvements to AR and ARKit. They're planning on integrating more digital health features. I think we've seen some of that in the previews of iOS 11.3. They have the whole new health records section, so you can connect that with participating hospitals and get your patient records and have that integrated. And the report also claims that Apple will be looking to make iPhones more responsive to try and reduce requests for customer service. And I assume this means with older models. So that often, you know, levied complaint that older model iPhones get slowed down with newer versions and new releases of iOS. So this time around, they're going to focus on maybe making that not be the case. And your iPhone running iOS 12, even if it's old, even if it's an older model, might even perform better because of these changes and Apple not having to focus on so much on trying to roll in major new features into the operating system and the apps. So again, I think that's a really good thing. The other feature that reportedly is still staying in there is this idea for developers to be able to create a universal app. This would be to have a single code base for writing an app that will allow them to put that app both on iOS and on the Mac. And don't think of this, what I'm reading about this is I don't think this is just the ability to, say, write an iOS app and have it run like an iOS app on the Mac. It would be an underlying code base that then would have a user interface and a UI that would be appropriate for either platform. It's just the developer wouldn't have to write two cores to their application like they do now. And Bloomberg sort of backed up this report from Axios that this is still going forward. Apple is still planning on developing this. I would assume that we're going to hear a lot more about this at Worldwide Developer Conference in June. But the project is reportedly called Marzipan, and it should simplify the developer tools and create a unified code base for both Mac and iOS development. And as a matter of fact, some of this kind of exists already because Apple has a private framework called UXKit that they have supposedly used for the Photos app on the Mac. And if you have seen Photos on iOS and on the Mac, you know that the user interfaces are very similar and a lot of the functionality is very similar. So it's similar supposedly to iOS's UIKit, and UXKit sits above the Mac's AppKit layer. So it kind of acts as the UIKit on the Mac, at least for the Photos application. And it's assumed that Apple is sort of leveraging that kind of technology for Marzipan. So we'll have to see if that happens this year, but that looks like that's still going forward as well. So Apple obviously still has lots of stuff to work on, even without these other major new features that are getting held off for another year. And again, I ultimately agree with that strategy. It's also being said that the planned upgrades for Apple Watch and Apple TV, some of the other products and new features there, those aren't going to be affected by this whole delay in some of the iOS 12 features. So ultimately a good thing in my opinion, although I'd love to know what you think. You know, do you think it's more important for Apple to put in major new features to iOS so that people keep wanting to upgrade and get the newest, latest, and greatest stuff? Or do you think it's time for Apple to dial things back a little bit and maybe focus a little bit more on the refinements, you know, more of a Snow Leopard or a macOS High Sierra update on the iOS side? And I'm totally for the latter, if you couldn't tell already, but I'd love to know your opinion, so share that with us. All right, with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. Hey, do you have an idea for the next big thing? What is it? Maybe it's a podcast. Maybe you're looking at starting your own business, starting up your own thing. Maybe you want to start your next career and you want to look for a job, or you want to show off your portfolio or your creative work. Well, chances are to do that, you're going to need a website, and Squarespace is the perfect tool to give you the website you need to make that idea happen. You can do everything yourself with Squarespace because really they make it so easy. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers, so you know your site is going to look great. Those designs are responsive, so it's going to be great on mobile. It's going to be great on desktop. They offer free and secure hosting that's managed and maintained. That means you're not going to have to deal with a bunch of updates or worry about security things. They're going to handle that for you. You've got analytics and your search engine optimization built in there, so you'll know people can find your site and you'll know who's visiting. And all of that is backed by their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And I can tell you from having used their customer support, they are absolutely great. I love Squarespace because I've used it for a number of projects here on the MacCast. I've used it to build some great event sites. We've held some special events and I need to put a site together very quickly and easily. And Squarespace gave me all of the tools to make that happen. Features like maps and event calendars, social media integration, sign-up forms. Everything I needed was right there with Squarespace, and they made it simple for me to have a site and ready to go in really a matter of minutes rather than days or weeks. You know, you're not going to spend a ton of time having to develop something. You can have something up and running that looks fabulous, and away you go. And what I particularly enjoy about Squarespace is they give you everything in one place. You get the domain name, hosting, a great website template, and all the advanced features you could possibly ever need, all along with that great customer support. So go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch your website, use the offer code MACCAST, and you're going to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. So think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace. You're going to love them, and a big thank you to Squarespace for their continued support of the MacCast. So something we've been trying to do here on the MacCast and in our community over the past couple weeks is share kind of positive, happy experiences with Apple support. Because for a while, you know, Apple was going through some rough stuff, and some of us have not been totally happy, and I have to admit myself on a few occasions, been happy with how support has been going with Apple. So I asked you out there, you know, what are your experiences? And I have to say, overwhelmingly, I think we're getting more and more positive experiences than negative experiences. And this week is no exception, because Camille wrote in to share an Apple support story with me on something that went a little bit awry, but ultimately ended up with a happy ending. I think you'll hear. Basically, what was going on is his wife's Series 0 Apple Watch started failing. The battery started going out to the point where it was really only lasting about half a day. And she was very much one of these people who likes to complete her rings, and you can't do that when your battery is failing. So they brought it into the Apple store in Brandon, Florida. And they took a look at it. They did some things. They reset some things, fiddled with some settings, sent them back on their way, said, try this out, see how that goes. So they got some good support there. Ultimately, that didn't work, and they had to come back in. And at that point, they just analyzed it and said, look, you need a new battery. They were perfectly willing and happy to pay for a battery replacement. So they checked it in, sent it into Apple for the battery replacement. And then after about 2 weeks or so, Camille had not heard back from Apple and thought that was a bit strange. And when he went to follow up on it, check on it with Apple, they said, oh, well, you know, that watch was sent back and delivered to you a couple days ago. And he said, oh, wait, no, we didn't get it. And in further investigating, unfortunately, Camille verified that while they had the correct address on his support ticket, somehow they had sent the watch to an old address for them instead. And needless to say, that Apple Watch was long gone. So Apple apologized for the mistake, and they asked Carmillo and his wife to come back into the store there in Bradenton, Florida. And once they got in there, they apologized again and explained that, unfortunately, they don't make the Series 0 Apple Watch anymore, but they reassured him that they would give him a model as good or better than his Series 0. And as a matter of fact, they ended up replacing it with a Series 3 cellular Apple Watch model with a Milanese loop band thrown in free of charge, plus AppleCare Plus on top of that. So needless to say, Carmillo and his wife went away from that Apple store feeling very happy about how the staff and the people at Bradenton, at the Bradenton, Florida Apple store handled the situation. And he wanted to write in and share that story with us. And I have to say, that's a pretty good one. I think you couldn't ask for a better outcome than that, other than, I guess, maybe hoping that Apple didn't lose your Apple Watch. But, you know, these things happen. I don't think that was really Apple's fault. And they certainly took care of the situation in the right way. And just another great story about how good Apple support really can be when they do it the right way. And I would say more often than not, Apple does get it right. So, Carmio, thank you for emailing in and sharing your story with us. All right, I'm not sure when you're going to be hearing this episode of the MacCast, but if you're getting it in the week I released it, then this week is HomePod week. The HomePod is arriving at the end of the week. I have one on order. I'm going to be picking it up from my Apple retail store on Friday, February 9th. And so look forward to my initial thoughts and review here on the MacCast. But all in all, I am really excited about HomePod and the potential of HomePod. And I wanted to follow up with a couple of new features and things that we learned about this week related to HomePod in case you might be getting one of your own. One interesting detail is it does look like it's running some sort of variant of iOS. And if that is the case, then it's likely going to be running a similar version. So the current version would be 11.2.5, then moving to 11.3. So it's likely going to be on the same release cycle for updates of its operating system as your iPhone and your iPad. And that being the case, it looks like those iOS updates are going to actually be managed by the Home app, because if you remember the last episode of the MacCast, we talked about the fact that the HomePod will be set up with HomeKit and show up in the Home app in terms of a lot of its management. So it really is like almost a HomeKit speaker to a certain degree, obviously a very advanced HomeKit speaker. And there are hints in iOS 11.3 that that is going to finally bring AirPlay 2, which means the support for stereo pairing and AirPlay 2 potentially on the HomePod as well. So Apple, when they announced the HomePod, unfortunately said that those two features were not going to be there at launch on February 9th, but they were coming later this year. And we really didn't know what later, or I don't even know if it said later this year. I think it just said coming later or coming soon. And we didn't know what that specifically meant. iOS 11.3 is expected to be out this spring. So at the earliest, we're maybe looking around the March, mid-March timeframe, like March 20th. It could be all the way through to June. But I'm guessing somewhere around March, you will probably get that stereo pairing feature along with AirPlay 2 on your HomePod. Another interesting tidbit, and something I really didn't think about too much, but is the fact that the HomePod is going to support peer-to-peer AirPlay. It does have AirPlay 1 out of the box on launch, and that means that you could actually stream content directly to your HomePod without having to connect it to your Wi-Fi network. That also means that if you have friends and family coming over and they just want to play music through your HomePod, they'll be able to do that as well and not have to connect to your home network. And so, you know, a lot of people have complained, well, it doesn't have Bluetooth or it's not supporting Bluetooth playback. Well, if it has direct peer-to-peer Wi-Fi playback, then it probably doesn't matter too much. I guess your friends maybe on their Android devices won't be able to play music or stream music directly to your HomePod, but all of your iOS devices should work just fine. And I thought that was a good little reminder that that feature is in there. All right, so that's a couple of the new features and things like that. I'm also starting to get some questions from members of the community about the HomePod, and specifically a lot of you want to know, you know, do I need a HomePod? Should I buy a HomePod? What's going on there? Samson wrote in this week and he wanted to ask about buying a HomePod. And specifically, he said, I just need your thoughts on buying a HomePod. The thing is I have mostly Sonos products. I have Apple Music and my library is also on Apple servers. I love music and Apple. And I know that Sonos has their smart speaker, but I prefer Apple's privacy and security that they have with Siri. So what do you think? And Samson, you know, I think this is a bit tricky because I love Sonos. I own Sonos products. I think they're absolutely great. As a matter of fact, just this week, I hooked my Sonos up to my Amazon Echo to play around with it a little bit. And I have to say that I was very impressed. It worked really great. You know, it can play back music. I can control the volume on my Sonos all with my voice from my Amazon Echo. And so, you know, when folks are asking me, should I get a HomePod or some other thing, or I already have something great like Sonos, do I need a HomePod? It's a little bit of a hard question to answer. And I think part of that is because we don't have the HomePod yet. You know, I think at this point, Sonos is very much a more mature speaker product. There's other more mature wireless speaker products out there. I think Bose has a system, and there's just a wide range of offerings. And at this point, the HomePod is really unproven. You know, a few people have heard it. A couple people have had, you know, maybe an hour of hands-on time with it, but it really hasn't been extensively tested. And also, at launch, you're not going to have features like stereo pairing, which are going to be important if you're going to compare it to a full-blown, say, Sonos system. So, you know, the early reviews have been great. They have said it's really good. The HomePod quality is going to hold its own up against systems like the Sonos. But that's still all being said without anyone actually owning one, right? That's controlled environments. That's Apple kind of controlling the dialogue on it. So really at this point, it's pure hearsay. Until I actually assess it for myself, or actually you're able to assess it for yourself, I think that's a little bit of a hard question to answer. So that's on just the speaker and audio front. On the smart speaker front, the Home Assistant front, you know, I'm a little less certain about that for any product. You know, Amazon is great. I've heard great things about the Google Home. And we have Siri. And I know I am a big fan of Siri. I know other people don't like Siri all that much. And they maybe like Amazon a little bit better. I think the personal assistant thing is really going to come down to a number of factors, personal preference being one of those things. But I also think a big part of it is, what ecosystem do you want to play in? Do you want to play in the Amazon ecosystem and go with the apps and services that support that? Are you all in with Apple and Siri and HomeKit? Or, you know, are you a Google person and you've got all your data and your stuff inside Google? That's going to be a big factor behind that. Obviously, privacy and security of your data and information, that's also a factor in there. And if you really care about that, if that is your number one thing, then I think Apple and Siri and HomePod probably is your only answer. Because, frankly, Google, in my opinion, Google and Amazon are doing next to nothing to protect consumers' privacy, and very little to protect the security of their products. I mean, they're pretty much wide open in a lot of ways. I know they have some security features built in. I don't want to, like, you know, overstate the fact or understate their security there, but certainly they're nowhere near at the same level as you know, Apple is thinking about this stuff. So, you know, you have that factor there. So I really think this comes down to, especially for Apple fans, how much are you willing to be an early adopter or a tester for Apple's new high-end audio experiment plus, you know, audio product plus smart speaker? You know, that you really have to think about. The other thing you have to think about is, are you really invested in Apple? At launch, HomePod is, you know, 100% an Apple product. It's only supported by Apple, by iCloud, by HomeKit, Apple Music, or iTunes and the cloud services. So you need to have all of your stuff in the Apple ecosystem. There's no third-party integrations for Siri and HomePod outside of that. So if you're living outside of that, like if all your music is Spotify, you know, at least at launch, HomePod's not going to be for you. I think there's eventually going to come third-party support. How rich and robust that third-party support is going to be remains to be seen, and it might be limited. It's certainly probably not going to be as robust as it is for Siri and HomePod. So I think all of those things you have to factor into your decision on, you know, do I get a HomePod? But if you're 100% happy with your Sonos system and you're not willing to take kind of a dice roll on HomePod and Apple, then I would say it's really, at this point, a wait and see approach. It doesn't mean that you're not eventually going to get a HomePod or HomePod's not eventually going to be the right product for you. But on day one, I don't know that you'd want to drop down, you know, plunk down $350 US, which is a lot of money to spend on a speaker just to be, you know, kind of a beta tester for Apple, a public beta tester, let's say. So again, if you really like Sonos, you're happy with it, it's a great option, and Sonos has already said that they're going to be adding HomeKit and Siri support to their system sometime in 2018. So those features are coming. Now, keep in mind the Siri functionality is likely going to be limited to music playback, and you're going to be running that through your iOS device. It's not going to be built into the smart speaker. I know that they have the Sonos One system that has Alexa built into it, and I think they're bringing Google Home support to that product as well, but they're not going to be able to integrate Siri into that because Apple doesn't have that kind of openness with Siri. So Siri's always going to operate through your iPhone. So it's going to be a different experience, and it's going to be a music-only experience. So you're going to be able to control music playback, but you're not going to get the same kinds of Siri functionality that you are going to get with a HomePod in terms of integrating it with your iCloud stuff, like your contacts and your calendars and all those sorts of things. So just keep in mind, that is coming, but it's going to be a different experience. So I think all of these things have to go in and factor into the decision. So, you know, ultimately, I think not just to answer the question for you, but to answer kind of the question and just my opinion on should you buy a HomePod right now for the community at large, I think if you're a total Apple fan, you're all in on Apple, and you want to be an early adopter, yeah, I think, you know, that's me. I fit in that category. I'm super excited about HomePod. I think it's going to be awesome. I think I'm really going to enjoy it for a lot of reasons. Now, if you're outside of that, I kind of feel like it's a wait and see position. You know, if you're anywhere on the fence, I would lean towards keeping that money in your pocket and waiting for the guys like myself who are going to jump in with both feet and not even look to kind of weigh in on it. You know, let us take that risk and see if it's worth it, and then we can share an honest opinion with you. And I think certainly ultimately, especially at the price point, it's definitely not for everyone. There are a lot of really good solutions out there that are going to be at a lower price point that I think a lot of people are going to be very happy with and are going to integrate very well into their lives. But it certainly is an exciting product, and I understand why so many of us in the community are excited about it and maybe do want to jump in with both feet, you know, go head first. But I'm not sure that it's really right for everyone. So hopefully, that all makes sense, and you get what I'm trying to say there. I think that was pretty clear. Hopefully I didn't ramble too much, but I'd certainly open it up to the opinions of the rest of the community. If you have thoughts on this, you know, should people be buying HomePods? Who's the HomePod for? Who should be jumping in? Who should be waiting? Share your opinions with us. Shoot me an email or send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing we've been talking about over the past couple weeks is this idea of being able to use multiple iTunes accounts or iTunes in multiple countries. I guess there's many of you out there who kind of bounce between multiple countries. I'm purely a U.S. store person, so I never leave the U.S., unfortunately. I don't go too many places, and all of my accounts and my credit cards and everything is here. But a lot of people seem to travel internationally, and you maybe want to get access to content in another country's iTunes store that maybe you can't get in your country of origins store. So we've been discussing, how can you do this? How can you have and manage multiple iTunes store accounts and access content in different countries? And Ralph wrote in this week to say, hey, you know, I'm in this category. I toggle between the U.S. and the Canadian stores. And he had this little bit of advice that kind of clarified things a little bit, I think, for how at least he manages it. He says, you know, what I do is I set up three different accounts. I have one that is an Apple ID just for iCloud. So it's like an iCloud only account. And he uses that for all the iCloud services like mail and calendar and contacts and syncing. But that account is not tied to any Apple ID that's tied to any of his iTunes accounts. And then he sets up a separate iTunes account for each country. And then you could choose to have a credit card tied to each one of those accounts, a country-specific credit card tied to a bank from that country. But in Ralph's case, he says it's much easier for him just to fund it using iTunes gift cards from that country. And I think I brought this up on the last episode of the MacCast, that unfortunately, to use an iTunes gift card, those are specifically tied to the country in which you purchased it. And that goes for and includes also virtual gift cards that you might buy through the iTunes store. So if you go into the iTunes store and buy a US gift card, it will only work in US iTunes accounts, which I think is totally lame, especially in the global economy that we live in, because that means that if I wanted to send a gift card to a friend or a family member who is outside the United States, I can't do it. I can't send it to them because I can only buy a U.S. gift card and they won't be able to use a U.S. gift card outside of the U.S. iTunes store. But in this case, where you're trying to use multiple accounts, it may benefit you. But again, the big tricky part is, how do I get a gift card from another country? Well, if you're bouncing between the countries, it's pretty easy because you can walk into a retail location and buy a gift card for that country. And I think that's what Ralph does, is when he's in Canada, he buys Canadian gift cards. And when he's in the US, he buys US ones, and then you can use them in either country. But one thing Ralph mentioned in terms of maybe getting around that restriction was, well, maybe you could use a VPN. So if you use a service like TunnelBear or some other VPN service, you could pick the country that you want to buy the gift card in and then purchase it there. Although I started thinking about this, Ralph, and I'm not sure that would work. Maybe some members of our community can verify this, and I still would like the definitive answer. What's the easiest or best way that is secure and not janky to get a gift card from another country if you want to be able to do that? Because I've seen places online, like people sell them on eBay. That's, you know, maybe minorly shady, but I've also seen like just services that sell iTunes gift cards from other countries, but they're always these weird, you know, third-party websites, the kinds of websites that I typically tell you, you know, that's where you don't want to go. You're probably going to get phished or get some sort of virus. So if somebody knows a good legitimate source, a good way to buy iTunes gift cards from other countries, let me know. Because I have a feeling, Ralph, that if you just try to use a VPN, that I'm still so... Say I set up a VPN and I say I'm in the UK, I go through a UK server, I switch my iTunes to the UK iTunes store, I add a iTunes gift card in the UK iTunes store to my shopping cart, I go to checkout, ultimately I'm still using a US credit card tied to a US bank with my address and zip code on it. So I think at that point, I'm still going to get shut down because it's not a UK registered credit card. Not entirely certain on that. You know, maybe your idea totally would work. And if somebody knows if it does, let us know that too. So how do you manage the payment part? So I get the fact that we can have multiple international iTunes accounts and we can switch between them and we can manage our purchases and we can even update our apps from either one. And that's not a problem. We've talked about all of that. How do you handle the actual buying part of it because of how all the checks and balances Apple seems to have in place to not allow us to buy content that is not from our country of origin iTunes store? So shoot me some feedback on that, maccast@gmail.com. All right. Next thing I want to play for you is a comment and a question from a MacCast listener about the smart keyboard on the iPad Pro. And I mainly want to share this one with you because this is actually an issue that I've run into recently too, and I have a similar question. So I think ultimately I'm going to share how I've been dealing with this problem, but I ultimately want to know from you if you have a good fix for this problem. And it's not just me that wants to know, it's also Glenn. So here was Glenn's question.
Hey, Adam, this is Glenn Price calling. Hope you're doing well. Yeah, I've really appreciated your podcast over the years. Really agree with some of your latest reviews of the AirPods. I've got some and I've got a pair and I'm really enjoying them as well. I'm calling, however, with a question about an issue I'm having with an iPad Pro, purchased in December 2017, 12-inch, and specifically with its smart keyboard. The smart keyboard doesn't engage regularly, meaning that when you open it up, it often takes quite a bit of monkeying around with the iPad and the connector and the connection into the groove to get the keyboard to work, the actual physical keyboard. And I'm wondering if you and or any of your listeners might have some good solutions to this problem. It's discussed in a number of the Apple support forums. Nobody seems to have come up with one, but I'm wondering if maybe you do. Anyway, nothing urgent, but if you have a chance to get back to me, that would be great. Thanks a lot, Adam. Keep up the great work. Bye-bye.
Hey, Glenn. As I was saying, this is actually an issue that I've run into recently as well. I don't know where it falls on the timing. I have this feeling that for me, I started having this problem when iOS 11 came out. I did have an issue before this with an iPad Pro keyboard. I have a 12.9-inch iPad Pro, and I took it into the Apple Store, and they actually replaced it with a new one, and everything seemed to go okay. And I think this was still when I was running iOS 10. I don't remember which version. But then iOS 11 comes out, and I have found that when I have the keyboard attached to the iPad Pro in typing mode, so it's folded out so that I'm using the keyboard, it'll sometimes just stop or lose the ability to type. Basically, what happens is I can tell when it disconnects because if I'm in an app that is a typing app, has the keyboard available, the on-screen keyboard will just suddenly slide up. So I'll be, sitting there typing away or doing something, and suddenly the on-screen keyboard will come up, which means that it's not recognizing the attached smart keyboard on the smart connector. And what I've found is that if I'm in typing mode, I can sometimes just kind of pull the screen forward, so kind of lean it toward me, and then put it back into the stand, and kind of like rocking it back and forth a little bit, and it will eventually and very often re-engage. So it almost feels like it's losing the physical connection, even though it's still physically connected. So I think it's more of a software thing, but I'm not entirely sure what's exactly going on. So I end up having to do this little rocking dance, and then it'll eventually come back. And sometimes it happens on the first time where it comes back, and sometimes I have to rock it back and forth a few times to get it to work. And then in the most extreme situations, I actually end up having to do a full hard reset of the iPad to actually get things working again. So I'm pretty sure this is a software bug, but I'm afraid, unfortunately, other than my little fix that I just told you about, my little workaround, I don't have any kind of permanent fix. I kind of feel your pain. I'm in the same exact position as you are, and it's really frustrating, especially sometimes when I'm just trying to type out some show notes, say, for the MacCast, and it keeps doing it over and over again. It's really, really annoying. And I keep hoping that it's something that Apple will fix in a future software update, but I'm already up to and running the public beta of iOS 11.3, and I can tell you, if it is a software bug, it's not fixed yet. So let's throw it out to the community. Hey, you out there, do you have the same problem? Do you have a potential fix for it? let us know, because Glenn and I would like to know, and hopefully maybe somebody from Apple's listening. I certainly will probably at this point, now that I know it's not just me, Glenn, I probably will go to apple.com/feedback, or even in the beta feedback, provide them feedback and let them know that this is an issue. And hopefully it's not like a rampant hardware issue with the keyboard itself. I had already thought about making a Genius Bar appointment and going in and having them look at my smart keyboard and see if this one needs to be replaced as well. But maybe it's a software thing. Hopefully it's a software thing and not a hardware thing. But maybe also someone in the community, you out there, maybe one of you knows what's going on. If you do, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. All right, last thing that I have for you is another thing that comes up quite frequently, because many of you are like me, and you are the tech support for not only your immediate family, but maybe remote family and friends out there somewhere. And on the Mac, we have a bunch of great tools that we can use to do screen sharing. You know, you can use Skype, or you can use now Discord, or any number myriad of remote control, remote access applications to share a screen and kind of help each other out and help friends and family out and walk them through the process of fixing something when something goes wrong on their Mac. But on iOS, we're somewhat limited in what we can do. A lot of times it devolves into really long text instructions, or you maybe get somebody on a phone call and you're trying to walk them through, without really being able to see their screen, clicking on something or tapping on something, and it gets to be kind of this exercise in frustration. Well, David wrote in to say that he's been doing a lot of tech support using a new feature that's built into iOS 11, the screen recording feature. And I know I talked about this when it came out and sort of how to activate it, but I don't know that we really talked about it too much in depth. And I thought it would be a good reminder to some of you out there who might not realize that you do have a screen capture feature built into iOS now, starting with iOS 11. And David's been using it to kind of send video instructions to help friends and family members. But he also pointed out something that he had struggled with, which is, I think when you activate it by default, it just captures the screen. There's no audio associated with it. So, you know, something even I had done at one point was take that video and bring it into like iMovie on my iOS device and then record a voiceover to go along with the video steps that I was recording. Well, David pointed out that if you go into the recording feature, the screen recording feature, and you tap and hold on the button or force touch the button, you actually will get a pop-up with additional options, including an option to turn on the built-in microphone so that you can actually record audio as you're taking your screen capture. And that can be really helpful when you're doing the whole video thing. Some other options that you'll see in that screen also is if you have an app that supports Apple's Replay Kit, that's the ability to actually broadcast, live stream broadcast to an app. And I know like Facebook has support for this. I think Twitch and some of the other video game apps have support for that, being able to live stream your video game session through Replay Kit. Those apps will also show up in this little menu. So to access that, you have to tap and hold or force press on the record button in the control center. And I guess we should back up a little bit for those of you who are going, I didn't know there was a recording feature on iOS and a screen recording feature, and I don't even know how to turn it on or how to access it. You actually access it through Control Center. It's a new Control Center control. And for those of you who don't know, to add new things or manage your Control Center, what you do is on your iOS device, you go into Settings, you go into Control Center, and then you tap on Customize Controls. And then there are all kinds of new Control Center controls that you can put in, and you can even grab the little handles and reorder your items as they appear in your Control Center. And this is all starting with iOS 11. So if you go into the Customize Controls, you'll see all of the different controls that you have access to. The ones at the top are the ones that are currently active and installed, and at the bottom, you'll have a bunch that have a little green icon icon next to them. So to add screen recording, you just press the little plus icon, little green icon next to screen recording. That'll throw it up to the top of the list, and then you can use the handles to set its position and place it inside your control center. And then once you have it in there, when you go pull down control center by swiping down at the top of your iPhone screen, you will see the button for screen recording. And if you just simply tap on that once, you're going to get a 3-2-1 countdown, and then it will start recording your screen. Again, if you force touch or press and hold on that, you'll get some additional recording options, and then you can tap record, and then it will do that same countdown. And then once it's started recording, what you'll get is you'll get a red bar at the top of your display. If you're on an iPhone 10, you're going to get the little red highlight around the left horn and the clock on your iPhone, and that will indicate that you're currently in a screen recording session. And then you can tap the red bar or the little red highlight around your time to actually stop the recording. And then when you stop the recording, by default, it is going to save that video to your camera roll, and then you can take it from there. You can share it, you can bring it into iMovie, do additional editing on it, whatever you want to do. And it, like David said, is great for sending little tech support help videos to friends and family when you're trying to teach them how to do something on their iOS device. So great little tool. The only one thing I wish they had, and hopefully they'll add this in a future update, is the ability to turn on an option where it will actually highlight and show where you're touching on the screen as you're going through the screen recording. Right now, they don't have anything like that. So in some instances, when you're trying to share something with somebody, it may or may not be really obvious what you're actually tapping on. So you kind of have to verbally say, and then tap on this icon and describe things. So just be aware of that if you're trying to create a little instructional video using screen recording for someone on iOS. But I thought that was a great tip. And David, thank you for writing in and sharing that with us. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. That is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iOS and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. I also want to thank supporters to the MacCast, specifically my Patreon supporters. You all are awesome. I've had a bunch of new Patreon supporters sign up this week, so thank you if you've done that. Your direct support means a lot to me. I really appreciate everyone who has pledged their direct support to the show. If you do want to support the MacCast, you can get details on how to do that at patreon.com/MacCast. And I am going to be announcing pretty soon the first couple of events of 2018 that I'm going to be attending. So watch the Patreon feed for that. That's going to be specifically for those of you who are Patreon members at the $5 or higher level. As you know, one of your benefits is if you run to me at an event, I will buy you a drink, a coffee, a soda, whatever drink of your choice. And so I look forward to being out on the road more this year with the help of Patreon supporters and being able to do that for you. So check that out. Another way you can support the show, if you don't want to directly support through Patreon, is please, and this really helps a lot, if you can take a moment, go in and rate and review the show on iTunes, that really helps with my iTunes rankings. So just jump in there. You don't have to say a lot. Just say whether you like the show or you don't like the show. I just want honest reviews. Please be straightforward, be kind, but be straightforward and give the show a rating. And that helps as well. And that doesn't cost you anything other than a little bit of your time. So if you can do that, I would certainly appreciate that. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, if you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and you can leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.